Hey, Crackenbacks listeners, ever wonder if the secret to fighting cancer lies in our workouts? Today, we've got world-renowned exercise physiologist, Dr. Riggs Kilka, in the studio. This genius bridge-building high-intensity interval training with, wait for it, cancer rehabilitation? We have a great discussion when we explore the shocking parallels between elite athletic performance and cancer survivorship. From Italy to the U.S., Dr. Kilka's experiences are reshaping our understanding of exercise oncology. Plus, a sneak peek into the groundbreaking future of personalized exercise regimes in cancer treatments. This episode? It's a game changer. If you've ever been touched by cancer or know someone who has been or just love a mind-blowing medical revelation, you can't miss this. Share, subscribe, and get ready for a knowledge explosion. Let's crack it.
All right. Hey, Doc, it's great to see you. And it's been way too long, since we've been hanging out in a surfboard in the Pacific Ocean. And it's so honored to have you. I know you're traveling around the world. You just got back from a river trip to Amsterdam. And now you're living back in Aspen, Colorado. So welcome to our show. I appreciate you, man.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks. Good to see you, Terry. Yeah.
All right. With your rich career involving various positions in academia at both the Olympic level and the professional level, you were the team physiologist for the U.S. ski team, among other things. You have a lot of experiences in current positions that led you to the research in the field of athletic performance and cancer survivorship. How did all that, let's give a little background how this all transpired.
It's a good question because people ask me quite a bit. It's like, do you have family members that were affected by cancer? And that's the reason you got into this. And I do. I lost my father to metastatic colon cancer and my sister to metastatic breast cancer. But, and those are horrific. I think everybody gets touched by cancer at some level, whether you have it or you have a relative or a friend or something that has it. But that really wasn't how I got into cancer survivorship. I had come off the U.S. ski team and moved back to Colorado, and I had done quite a bit of personal training, and I had a young athlete I was coaching, and his mother had breast cancer. And she had called me up and said, hey, they told me I shouldn't be doing anything after my breast cancer, basically treatment plan. They said I shouldn't even lift up anything over 3 pounds. And I said, well, Mary, that's not really going to work. I mean, you got to carry your skis. Now we're up in Aspen, Colorado. You got to carry your boots and all that stuff is pretty heavy. And I said, it just didn't make a lot of sense. And I thought, let me use a little bit of my brain power to figure out what are the recommendations being made right now for cancer patients. This is about 2004. And so I started doing my homework on that. And I looked at the rehabilitation standards that were out there basically to follow. And it was basically coming from a nursing background. Love nurses. I love what they do. Bright ladies. But the recommendations following cancer treatment really didn't have any evidence-based medicine behind it at all. It was just suggestions and anecdotal evidence. So I kind of took it upon myself to sort of look at how we treated Olympic athletes at the time. And could I just apply that, but at a different level, taking into considerations that I should take into consideration, I mean, the medications that they're on, the adjuvant therapies that we're on, and monitor this person. So I spent a year doing that. And then all of a sudden, that sort of snowballed. And then I got more and more clients. And they were like, well, what are you doing for Mary? Why is she, looking so good and so fit and so happy? And we just sort of went from there, and it snowballed into starting to work with cancer patients. So that's the long story of how I got into it.
That's great. I think it's a fascinating combination of things because I've never heard about having such a making exercise such an integral part of oncology and maybe rehab after chemo and things like that, because otherwise you don't hear anything about it and you don't know what the parameters are. So how do you see the integration coming
coming along now is, you know, clinical exercise physiology and enhancing the quality of life for cancer survivors?
I think we've made tremendous strides in 20 years. Like I said, I'm talking about a 2004, if you will, with no standards, to where we actually have now a new branch called exercise oncology, meaning what can we use as exercise? Lee Jones out of Memorial Sloan Kettering is looking at, can we even use exercise as a therapeutic to increase metabolism and clearance rates of all the drugs? And so we're actually researching that. Then Catherine Schmitz out of Penn State, you know, publishing in JAMA about 10 years ago about the effects of exercise in reducing lymphedema for breast cancer patients. That got a lot of traction because it obviously hit the Journal of the American Medical Association. So now we've got this small fraternity sorority of cancer researchers, if you will, that are working in exercise. It's a pretty small pocket, but really bright people doing really good work. We started at the basic levels of what can we do? What can't we do? What should we do? And now we're advancing that. Should we be, now we've incorporated our plans into rehabilitation, but what about during treatment? And that's a hot topic. I know, Terry, you were interested in sort of hot topics today. And is there something we could be doing during treatment with exercise that might help in the outcome measures that we're looking for, survival and decrease in side effects and whatnot? So it's come a long way. And Spencer, let me give you sort of one more little story on that. You know, I live up in Aspen, and, you know, we get a lot of people coming up here, and I see a lot of sort of movers and shakers in the world. And I was actually riding a ski lift with the director, one of the directors at MD Anderson in Houston. A lot of the Houston group comes up here. And I just, you know, by the by, was just saying, hey, yeah, this is what I do. And he goes, oh, I'd love to see what you do. And he came over and he goes, yeah, I'm going to just come over for about 20 minutes. He spent about 2 hours with me. And at the end of the phone call, he called up their Office of Cancer Survivorship and said, why aren't we doing a program like this?
Wow.
Now, this is 20 years ago, right? And even MD Anderson with 1,000 oncologists didn't have a cancer survivorship plan. Now they do.
Wow.
So it was really fun to be on that forefront of writing programming. And my expertise is programming, not necessarily oncology per se or treatment per se.
Yeah. But
so I've been involved in that level. And like I said, the people that are doing this work are really, really bright people doing good work.
You published an article in 2021 in the American College of Sports Medicine on health and fitness in their journal on high intensity exercise and cancer. Yeah. God, you got to elaborate on that because you would never put the two things together.
Right. So, you know, let's talk about cancer. As survival rates are going up, we're starting to look at it almost as a chronic disease, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of our chronic diseases, we're training people, right? We want them to exercise, certainly. We want them to get better weight control, better metabolic control, just the well-being you get from exercise. But so we're looking at cancer as a chronic disease now, especially with the survival rates going up so high. Well, we know the barriers also to exercise. Don't have enough time. Don't have a facility. I can't drive over there, whatever. And there's a myriad of variables that go into why we can't exercise. So in that article, the whole journal for that particular volume was devoted to high intensity exercise for a number of chronic diseases. So I was tasked to do the cancer component of it. Mm-hmm. And we just wanted to make sure that the efficacy, does it work first off, and was it safe? Mm-hmm. And in certain populations, as long as now there are, you know, cancer is very complex. And the different levels, the stages, the treatments, the side effects, the type of cancer. But if you're relatively healthy, and that's a really broad stroke there, can you do high intensity interval training to increase your cardiorespiratory fitness? You bet. And can it be done well? Yeah. So what constitutes high intensity? That was the other thing that we tried to define carefully about how high is high enough to stimulate, but not so high that we cause a problem. That's research that we're still trying to figure out, by the way.
I was actually going to ask you about how energy demands for someone who is exhausted and depleted and run down. And, you know, I understand that there's research regarding professional motorcycle racing. And if if you can touch off on, I know that's like Terry's favorite subject matter right there, but the parallels between the athletic performance in the field and rehab with cancer survivors.
I took Spencer, can I come a long way around to answer that? Just a
little bit again, too.
Let me be long-winded on that one.
Sure.
So I had one of the things I looked at was cancer-related fatigue when I was actually, Terry, down at Pepperdine. I was doing a nice project down there on cancer-related fatigue and looking at exercise and whether exercise decreases cancer-related fatigue. That sounds like it might not work, but it did. But what we first did, and I did it with a graduate student, is we did a very simple research lit on all the effects of what cancer-related fatigue actually is. And then I lined up overtraining of world-class athletes, and I put them side by side on a chart, and they were all the same. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about energy demands. Yeah. So wow. you're talking, okay, here's a cancer patient under this enormous load of a tumor burden and treatment. What ends up happening to someone like that? Okay. We understand they're trying to treat it. It's really depleting their energy reserves. It's having an incredibly maybe long-term effect on their cardiorespiratory fitness and muscle metabolism and bone mineral density, all those things. Those are exactly what happens to an overtrained athlete. And I sort of did an aha moment. Mm-hmm. And I understand the etiologies are completely different, but I said, you know what? We can manage athletes. I know how to manage athletes. I know what to measure for. I know how to put a load on them. I know how to get them out of being stale or overtrained. I know how to work on their nutrition, their mental well-being. And I said, could I apply that to my cancer patients?
Very cool.
And that's what we did. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So looking at energy demands really is important. And then, okay, what should we do? That always gets down to the questions like, what should I do with the group? And then I didn't have any direction, none. So I thought, okay, let's be careful. Let's do it right. But let's start working with this group and monitor them closely. And that's how I actually ended up starting. And then, you know, what happened is I documented very carefully all the loads that I put on my cancer patients, their blood works, the follow-ups with the physicians, everything very, very closely. And guess what? We weren't hurting anybody. And they were getting fit. Not just healthy, but fit. And fair enough, I had a fairly healthy group of cancer patients, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I worked them. I pushed them.
Yeah.
And we weren't hurting them. And that was the aha. It's like, okay, let's get this stuff published. And that's how I started down that road. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does it, to put it in like simple terms for some of the audience that isn't medically or healthcare oriented, but are highly interested in the perspective of training, you know, what are some of the consequences? Like, you know, we could easily overtrain an athlete that's been trained, you know, that's been training consistently. How do you know if you're overtraining a cancer patient?
That was a good question too. What metric should I be using to say they're overtrained? Because if I just give you chemotherapy and radiation, you're going to be tired one way or the other. There's just no question about it.
Yeah.
Okay. But we know that exercise will improve immune system function, will metabolize all the drugs a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what should we be looking at? And that was a good question. Because chemotherapy is always associated with taking blood work, I looked at complete blood counts. So I looked at their blood work. And I watched for their white blood cell and red blood cell counts. Mm. And if I saw them tailing in any direction downward based on basically blood work, I know that the load that I was putting them under was too much at that point, and we would back out from the exercise component of it. Doesn't mean we stop exercise. We would just back off on it. Well, it's kind of what you do with a world-class athlete, too. You monitor their red blood cells. Are they anemic? Are their white blood cells plummeting? Or are they elevated because they're sick? So what do we do with a world-class athlete? Well, we don't stop them from training, but we certainly pull off the load, and we did the exact same things. So I use blood work basically as a monitoring on the metric to see whether I should continue or not continue.
Super, super cool. So to put it into, basic training terms, like, what are you actually doing? What are you actually giving these cancer patients? And is it contingent on what cancer they may have? Lung, kidney, prostate, colon, throat? Is your regimen vary? Does it vary depending on their, the foci of the cancer and their, how far they end with treatment or how far they end with what stage they're in?
Let me address the first part, okay, Spencer, because that's a great question. When I first started and the research started coming out, we were looking at, you used a good word, foci of the cancer. Where's the tumor burden? Is it breast cancer? Is it pancreatic cancer? Is it a brain tumor? And should we treat those differently? Mm. Obviously, each one has a different effect on the body. I took a slightly different approach, not to discount the importance of where the tumor was, but I was looking at the treatment of it. Did they have chemotherapy, radiation, some type of immunotherapy, targeted therapy, adjuvant therapy? Because I was interested in the effects on the body of that treatment. Does that make sense?
Oh, first? Yeah.
And so a simple surgical procedure, maybe to remove a tumor, might be, no matter where it is, might be treated, or we might do rehab differently. But those that had all the therapies and that were stacked on top of each other, I had to put that all together, all the variables, to basically do the exercise program for them. And here's how I looked at the exercise program. I mean, in its most simplistic form, I thought aerobic-based training was the most important part to start with because I needed cardiovascular and cardiorespiratory health. I don't want to discount the other parts. You got to be strong. You got to have good bones. But that was going to be secondary. So first, let's make sure you can breathe and circulate oxygenated blood. Why? That'll help your stamina. That'll help you recover. And it'll help clear out the metabolites from the liver and actually process them out through the system. So we based our training programs that way. But then, okay, as we got more complex, you're right. Let's see. The women who undergo breast cancer treatment basically advance their aging process by 10 years. So they're now, if they were premenopausal, now they're menopausal. So they're going to drop their, obviously, all their hormones. They're going to drop their bone mineral density. They're going to increase the risk for cardiovascular disease. So we thought, okay, again, let's work on the heart and lungs, but better we start lifting some weights too in there somewhere to try to increase our bone mineral density. So then we had to work into that. And so that became interesting in and of itself. You can tell people to exercise, but the standard was don't lift a weight because you're going to exacerbate the lymphedema in your left arm.
Oh, yeah.
But we were like, guess what? We started doing that, and I went, that doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't, I'm not trying to, again, pretend like I knew the answers. I was just asking questions.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? If an athlete came to me and they had edema and swelling, I would use an active muscle pump and try to push it out of the system, or manual or massage or some other things like that. And so the lymphedema became a way of saying, well, why don't we just do some active muscle pumping and just do some exercise and see if we can reduce the lymphedema? And lo and behold, Katie Schmitz published that paper. And it was really fun to see because I was doing some work in that, but she published a paper she was doing on the East Coast. And it was just, it was really fun to see that come out. And that really, really, really helped us. So again, look into the athlete, look into the cancer patient, but how does exercise help?
You know, it's funny.
And then,
oh, sorry.
You guys are in the sort of like, you know, the rehabilitation side of this. Let's just say you see a breast cancer patient with a unilateral mastectomy. They're imbalanced. They're maybe even adhesive capsulitis or something along, you know, like a frozen shoulder or something along those lines. And they're protecting and they have horrible posture. Well, I work with a good aging population, certainly out here in Aspen quite a bit. My clientele is older. And posture is one of our key go-to sort of common threads that I am working on with everybody. Stand up taller, have better posture, work on your alignment. That was right in your wheelhouse, guys. So, So I'm taking breast cancer patients and going, here's what I do for healthy people. Here's what I'm going to do for breast cancer patients. Let's see if we can get this to all mesh together while I'm taking care of all the internals, if you will, the complete blood counts and white blood cell counts for the cancer patient.
So I've always heard about them not exercise like a bilateral, unilateral mastectomy. They have to remove all the lymph nodes. The arms are swollen and everything like that. And they've been afraid to exercise, which didn't quite make sense, but I knew nothing about it. Are you saying that some sort of exercise and, you know, maybe some compression wear, things like that would be helpful?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Without a question.
Oh, I think we need to.
I mean, now there are some people with severe lymphedema that is uncontrolled lymphedema.
Yeah.
That's a different group.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about somebody that's gone axillary node removal or a certain amount and they're having some problems with lymphedema.
Yeah.
You guys are both well-trained. I mean, you'd want to get that fluid out.
Right.
The last thing I would want to do is not move the affected arm.
Beautiful.
Yeah. You're leaving the lymph down in the peripheral tissues, right? So that wouldn't be the right thing to do. I just had to move them. It wasn't hard exercise. It was just rhythmic.
That makes sense. It makes sense. And I think in the degree of like when you said when there's a chronic lymphedema, like with cellulitis and things like that, maybe not to – okay. All right. Good.
That's a little different. And
yeah.
Lymphedema specialists are – excellent at working with that particular population. But I think it's certainly a risk. But again, I don't know that we had enough data to say that exercise was contraindicated.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's one of the ones we're working on right now. So
good.
I mean, we're 20 years into this. I think you're seeing a bulk of the information come in the last 20 years. So we're kind of a new science, if you will.
I love that. There's also, it was fascinating about maybe 8 years ago, my neighbor had bilateral mastectomy and, you know, with obviously, you know, a lymphadenopathy. And I don't know why I said something about using what you know of as kinesiology tape or kinesio tape or KT tape, you know, the elastic tape. And I don't recall. I had some I used on one of her kids or something like that. And she goes, I wonder if that would work on me. And I go, listen, I mean, I know nothing about this. Your skin looks, you know, healthy enough. We tried it. And then she found out that they were using it in one of the, you know, PT clinics or rehab clinics. And they would do the same type of kinesio taping on the arm to get lymph drainage going. But what was fascinating about that is that they would charge like four times as much for a tape job on a cancer patient than, you know, that I would on an athlete. And I go, oh, well, here you go. You know, so I just gave her a roll of tape.
I think compression has its use in that. I think, but here's another one of those good ones. Like, again, where I just jumped out and went, oh, okay, they have a compression sleeve. Well, if you put a compression sleeve on your arm and it's graded and it works obviously from the wrist up to basically the armpit, okay, the axillary nodes, you know what? It's got a cuff right there.
I
did the same thing for lower extremity lymphedema as well. So we just wear a surgical, you know, a stocking, if you will.
Yeah.
I said, we got to change that. And all the compression garments that are used in the athletic industry right now are outstanding, and they go over the arm and over the shoulder, and we can get compression in the arm. So I started, I still recommend that you use a compression garment that goes up and over the entire body for a breast cancer patient, and up and over the waist, so that the the lymphatic drainage, for those that don't know, I mean, it's obviously in near the armpit and near the inguinal folds, you know, basically down in the femoral region. And so why occlude that? See, and some of those were just sort of basic questions. Yeah. And like I said, I'm not the brightest guy, but I was using some of that physiology behind me, and I was like, okay, let's see what we can do. I think that's a better strategy. That's just an opinion. I don't want to go to war with the lymphedema specialists or anything like that.
Oh, why not?
but they do a good job, because lymphatic drainage is a really important component of it, like you said, for cellulitis, and it's got to be done if we have severe cases, for sure.
I'm sorry, Terry. Hold on a second. Do physical therapists, do they do lymphadenopathy? Is it the physical therapist's role in doing the similar type of stuff, or to understand what you do, or is it, you know, something that is exclusive to a different entity?
Well, there are lymphedema specialists and trained, usually coming from a nursing background, but the PTs have been thrown into it heavily. Yeah. We're doing such a good job. The oncologists are doing such a good job of getting people past treatment and keeping them alive, and we have all the side effects. So you're following up from a surgical procedure, you're going to PT. Mm-hmm. Well, the PTs, when I first started, a lot of them didn't have a lot of background in cancer survivorship. But I think that's changed. I see that in the curriculums now. As a former professor, mm-hmm. I saw that moving that way, which is great. Mm-hmm. I actually did lectures for PTs at the University of Indianapolis when I was there. Mm-hmm. That's good. And so they're addressing it first. But as you both know, PT is limited to a certain amount of visits. Boom, they're done. Mm-hmm. I was the guy kind of right after that surgical intervention and 12 sessions of PT. Yeah. Now what? Right. Okay, let's put you back together for the next 2 years, so to speak. And then hopefully the goal was get them healthy enough and back into their normalcy, if you will, within a year to 2 years, to see if we could get them. You know, cancer's tough. I was thinking when you asked me to come on this thing, and I recalled a lecture here where Harold Varmus, the former director for the National Cancer Institute, and he said something when I was young, and I'm just paraphrasing, but I remember him saying, you know, once you have cancer, you typically die of cancer, you know, even if you know, I know that's a horrible statement to say, but it comes back. And my thought was, wow, you know, that's the head of National Cancer Institute. This is one of the brightest men, brightest researchers. And that's a scary thought. My job was then, okay, boy, I hope I can make this person live as long as possible, but as healthy as possible. And if it does come back, maybe they have a better reserve capacity to handle the second time around. You know, that's kind of, again, sort of how a lot of that started. Sorry, that was, I went off.
No, that's good.
No. It's great.
You know, one of the questions I have is, you know, you have a vast experience traveling. I mean, you've worked academia in the United States and in Europe. How do these diverse environments and cultures and thought processes kind of influence your work, and what do they do better than we do, and what do we do better than they do?
That's a great question, Terry, because I think also preparing for today, I think you'd asked me what was some cutting edge things. And I do want to share one thing that I think is different. I spent a year working at the University of Florence in Florence, Italy, in the sports medicine department. Now, sports medicine departments in Italy are staffed by cardiologists, not orthopods.
Ooh, interesting.
Interesting, right?
Yeah.
So I have a dear friend, Laura Stephanie, who is there, one of the directors at the university. And one of my goals was to go learn basically a European model. And the really cool thing about being in Italy is I could travel to Heidelberg up at the National Tumor Center and meet with my colleagues up there and look at best practices. So I was able to do that. But here's one of the differences, Terry. we will send you, you can go to MD Anderson and you will get three outstanding physicians, all who will come and see you. Hopefully they come up with the same diagnosis. Most likely all three of them are going to come up with a slightly different treatment plan. Okay, that's great. And they're good. They're really good. You know, amen for that particular group. And then they treat you and MD Anderson says, okay, go home. So now you fly back to Kansas and you've been treated and you're kind of, you're cancer free, you know, so to speak at that point. But again, the follow-up at that point, well, in Italy, it was really interesting. All chronic disease patients go through, it's a basically a socialized medicine platform. And so if you had cancer or diabetes or chronic kidney disease, you go to see your specialist. They do their work and hopefully get the same response and get you cured, if you will, of the disease. Your next appointment is to go to sports medicine.
What?
Wow. All of them. So all the chronic disease patients come into our clinic. Seven cardiologists in this particular clinic, and we have a full exercise, EKG, echo, stress testing unit to test everybody. Now, let's go with that one a little bit. If you do cancer treatment, many times what we call it subclinical cardiomyopathy, meaning we probably damaged your heart. Our cancer treatments don't ever test you. They don't do an EKG on you. They don't even look at that. They said, we cured your cancer. And I'm, again, guys, I'm talking a little bit gross generalities here. That's not true for everybody. But that particular group in Italy has to come through. And so we check on their hearts. And we were seeing a lot of subclinical cardiomyopathy, meaning that it's not going. So, okay, we want you to get healthy. Obviously, socialized medicine. They don't want you to come back. They're going to live forever. It's Italy. So they want you to go back out and be productive out there. So we would do a complete test, just like I would do, Terry. You and I had done some work before, like we're trying to set up a performance testing lab and whatnot. You know, do the EKG stress test, do a VO2 max, do a bone mineral density scan, do sit and reach, do some power exercises. We'd have that. And then that group would tell them, that particular patient, what to do as part of their rehab. So we don't do that. And it's not incorporated. And I always thought that that was such a great addition to the healthcare system. And could it potentially help us with the treatments, knowing that somebody's got a slightly damaged heart? Or how hard should we be pushing them? I would have loved to have known that. When I started with my particular group of cancer patients, I had all the equipment, but I'm not a cardiologist. But I was still running EKG stress tests to look for some type of pathologies because I had people that wanted exercise. And then I had a physician consult with me to make sure that they were cleared to go out and do the exercise. But that's part of that group. So much, much different than ours.
Early on in your answer, you pose questions, you know, that are very, I want to highlight them because we strongly urge our patients to question authority or question. You mentioned, you know, you could send a patient to three different, you know, oncologists or three different doctors in the same field, and they'll give you a slightly different approach, or I call it a recipe of treatment that, you know, there's no standard. And so now you're embarking on creating a new standard of oncology or, you know, cancer care, if you want to call it. And I find that fascinating because it's really embarking on, you know, questioning the way things have been done and now moving into a new level of care. I love that.
I think they're really ahead of us on that particular component right there. I mean, I love the medical field in America. I mean, I go to an ER room in America, you're going to get outstanding care. But then, like, here's a perfect example of, boy, we could adopt a sort of more European model. I think we might. I think for the health of the nation, if you will, in our healthcare system. But man, that is so far beyond my wheelhouse, guys. Like, how to change that. I can just tell you that I think that was a great strategy to helping individuals. So yeah, there's an opinion statement right there.
Could you, I can't wait to hear about this research found or this foundation that you work with, Bridging Bionics. Could you share a little bit more about the background in exercise science and human development in that foundation?
Yeah, that's a great group of people. So I moved back to Colorado. I retired as a professor, if you will, but I need to be academic as well. So I still see cancer patients here. I have a small health facility, gym facility. But I jumped on to help a dear friend of mine, Amanda Boxtel, who was... I don't want to say like a poster child, if you will, but she was an advocate of using the ESCO bionic skeletons, the external skeletons, to help her walk. She's a paraplegic. She had a ski injury here. And so I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but the robotics, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
The external robotics. Yeah. And so she became a spokesperson for this particular group. She started a foundation up here where we're looking at trying to integrate as cutting edge technology as we possibly can with basically spinal cord injuries, stroke patients. The patient list is a myriad. It's a large list up here. But I was always fascinated with the interaction between prosthetics, if you will, and the human body. I think that's, and the DOD and the Department of Defense is really interested in that because of our soldiers and those that are injured in combat. So how could we put those people back together? And you've seen, you know, that hits the headlines because that kind of stuff is really, really spectacular when you can integrate maybe somebody that's lost their arm and make a prosthetic arm that actually responds to commands from the brain. I think that's, it's we're really hitting some really neat areas in neuromuscular function that are just really cool. And I think that they're still, our particular group is just trying to help people increase their mobility so they can be independent. But we're trying to use whatever is available to us. And we do some smaller research projects because we don't have a large population, but we do research and to say whether these projects are actually working. We just finished a study on virtual reality. So everybody has to come in that's got maybe a spinal cord injury and you know they've got some mobility issues and they can't move maybe, or maybe they have CP and some spasticity. With virtual reality, like the goggles, and you guys have seen it, you can almost, you know, do some of the games and play with them. Would that potentially help with neuro networking, if you will? So I would love to give you the answer to that question today. But I'm literally, we had the meeting last night and they asked me, do you have the results? I said, nope, I just have the data. So we just finished the study. So I don't have an answer to that. We know that the patients themselves enjoyed it. It sort of helps with compliance due to the rehabilitation. I think our group is a little bit small. I'm not 100% sure whether, you know, the control group versus the VR group actually had incredible changes in function. But you know, we're pushing those levels too. So that's a whole new area for me to be involved with.
That is unbelievable. So, okay. Now you are masterful at combining things that a subject from here and a subject from here, putting it together like cancer and exercise. How about cancer, exercise, and now, you know, paraplegics or quadriplegics and putting them in bionic. I mean, do you see patients that are disabled like that end up with cancers as well?
That's another great question, because one of the side effects we see quite often in our cancer patients is peripheral neuropathies, right?
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of peripheral neuropathies. From my understanding, the treatments of peripheral neuropathy are relatively poor. I mean, there's a lot out there, but they don't seem to work all that well. Exercises, we use it to the best of our abilities. I do a lot of power plate movements with some of my cancer patients, just to see if we can stimulate blood flow in the peripheries. But here's a, that would be a nice combination. So something I could learn from this side over here in Bridging Bionics, could it be helpful for cancer patients with peripheral neuropathy? It's a good question. You're like setting me up for the next project, right?
You're welcome.
I planted that seed in there. That's good. You use a power plate, which is high intensity vibration.
Yep.
For who? The cancer patient or the?
Of course.
Okay. That's what I thought you were going to say. So let me. I got to ask you. So there were. This is old school thinking. Too much circulation on a cancer patient will, you know, spread the disease or something. I mean, I know that's ancient. Well, I'm ancient, but old thinking. But you're using a power plate, and what are you looking to stimulate for those listeners out there and viewers?
Well, the peripheral neuropathy, for those that don't have the medical background, basically just a destruction of the small nerves in the periphery. And then ultimately they get side effects of basically pain or numbing or that old feeling of pins and needles in the feet, if that's a good way to put that for you. And the treatments for that are poor. There are some drugs that are used, but it doesn't work very well. So we just said, hey, this power plate is kind of interesting. We know it stimulates a lot of the peripheral muscles, the small ones. Well, that augments blood flow. Would that help in the regeneration of peripheral nerves, which do regenerate?
Yeah.
The animal model is clear. It works. If you exercise a rat with basically some type of peripheral neuropathy in it, exercise will actually help with the repair and growth of that peripheral nerve. It takes a while, but it works. Human beings are a little different. We're not quite so uniform. We all have different reasons and different stages of cancer and health, if you will, and age. It's promising. How's that?
I love it.
So I use it. It's not hurting anybody. And so to answer your question, does that increase blood flow? Is that causing a problem? No. No. That's not going to be our issue.
I like it. Okay. Now, switch gears just a little bit.
Sure.
Your postdoctoral training at the National Institute of Aging, especially at this age, I want to hear everything you got on anti-aging. No. All kidding aside, because I'm sure we don't have 10 hours to hear it, but...
I'll come back in the next.
Yeah. So, if there is one single subject that has the most convincing research, and that is exercise and anti-aging or, longevity, how do you intertwine that with, cancer survivorship? How have you installed that in for America to completely understand that?
You have to understand that cancer is a disease of the aging population. If you look at the prevalence rates coming up to about 50, they're relatively at a certain level. I'm not going to get into the stats. I have those, or you can look them up. But once you hit 50, you look at the prevalence rates of cancer in the United States, they go through the roof. So, once you get to 50, because you've got these cancers growing in you, we all have them, whether they get expressed or grow bigger, that's dependent on you and some genetics and some variability. But yeah, once you're up into that age 65, those death rates start to go pretty high. Mm. So it's a disease of the aging population, right? So what do we need to do? We need to prevent this first and foremost, just like we talked for the aging population. What are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to get them as healthy as possible, so when they get old, they can still continue to do things. When you're in cancer treatment, though, you age prematurely by about 10 years. Now, wouldn't it be cool? This is Spencer, where I really think that there's some neat information too. It's like, what's another good reason that you might want to exercise? Obviously, so you can go out and play with your grandkids and be healthy and do the things you want. So I could go out with Terry and do some stand up, out there at Point Doom, and those guys can hammer me out there in the surf. Okay, that's all great, but you certainly want to be functional. And now you've sort of gone through this premature aging. What if you were healthier? What if you had a certain level of fitness here and you did get a chronic disease, and you're out of commission for a while. That's horrible, but you come down to here. But the problem is Americans are starting here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not healthy. They're overweight. We're not exercising. We're not doing good things. I mean, you know, talking to you, maybe your listeners here, we're kind of the people that do and enjoy exercise, but not, that's not everybody. So they're starting here, and then the cancer takes them down here. We got a problem.
Yeah.
So my thought is, what can we do, obviously, to increase your reserve, if you will, from chronic disease? And then you might be able to respond better. We certainly are thinking at this point that the healthier individual with cancer, and I don't want to say this about everything because we do. Terry and I have a very good friend that's struggling, who's healthy as can be. And it hurts, you know, to watch those things. But for the general, you know, to be honest, he's around also because he's so strong. He has a ton of reserve capacity, and he can handle the treatments better.
Yeah.
So, you know, the exercise, you know, and prevention and pre-cancer is really important. What we're doing during treatment now is becoming important. And certainly afterwards, I want to try to get people as healthy as possible in case it comes back, the reoccurrence rates, or they pick up a secondary cancer. Or, you know, here's the reality. In America, they may not die of their cancer, but they're going to die of cardiovascular disease or some type of metabolic disease. So, you know, we're just trying to do the best we can with our little corner of exercise over here, as a medicine, if you will. Prescribe it, do it correctly, figure out the dosage, and see what the side effects are. Right now, the side effects are pretty good. We don't have a lot of adverse side effects. So.
Yeah, it's tough. It's I was going to say it's a tough pill to swallow, but actually, you know, it's hard. You know, that's the problem with America. They're swallowing too many pills because that's so easy to do versus going out and exercises or you know, understanding that food is medicine or it could also kill you, you know. So, you know.
And exercise, to answer your question about like sort of the National Institutes of Aging, you know, they're interested in all these things. They want to look at your bones, your heart, your metabolic, your mental well-being.
Yeah.
You know, are we one? You know, when I went there, that was a long time ago, 97. And I was the outcast. I was the one clinical exercise physiologist. Everybody else was coming at it from a different perspective. Let's put it that way. And it was fun to actually sit around in the round tables with very incredibly bright people. Yeah. But they're asking me about exercise, which I really enjoyed. You know, like I said, we're not the end all be all. I don't think, you know, exercise is not going to cure your cancer. It's just going to help us the best we can. But it's an important component of lifestyle management that it has to be part of it. And, you know, I think, you know, for the aging, move. The worst thing you can do, stop moving. You want a sure way to die? Yeah. Sit on the couch.
Very good.
Oh, I'm afraid to go out and do something. Well, sit on the couch. You're going to die faster that way, I promise you. And, you know, do you remember all those statistics back in the years where, you know, gosh, if you go out and do some exercise, you increase the risk of actually having some type of cardiovascular event? Well, none of that really made sense to me either. And when I started to do my homework on that, it's not really as big as we think. The risk-benefit ratio is way in our favor, if you will. Yes, there are a few people that go out and exercise and die, but there's a few. Most likely, it's the guy that gets off the couch and goes shoveling snow in Ohio. Sorry, I'm from Ohio. I can do that one. I can say that one. So my point being here is that we got to move. And we got, in the cancer patients, it really became apparent to me, it's like, you know what? They have cancer and they're getting training adaptations. That's really important. I mean, I really think that that's a piece of, you know, Terry, you're asking me some really cool stuff. Lee Jones did a study on stage 4 lung cancer patients. These people are going to die. And he trained them. And I was new into this area. And he got changes in VO2 max with this group. And then I said, okay, somebody goes, well, what's the functional outcome of that? He goes, well, the trained group lived about a month longer than the non-trained group. Now, remember, there's stage 4 cancer patients. They're all going to die. There's really, we don't have a treatment for them. Not much we can do. But they all got fit.
Yeah. Wow.
And they're dying of cancer, meaning I can push you pretty hard. And then somebody said, well, 1 month isn't very much. And I said, well, I don't know if you're struggling with that. End of life is really difficult stuff to talk about. But, when you're trying to get things together and you want to spend a little bit more time with your loved ones, well, even 1 month is important. Mm-hmm. But I remember asking Lee, I said, well, why would you train stage 4 cancer patients? Mm-hmm. He was a little naive on this one. And I think he's a brilliant physiologist. And he said, if I can get adaptations in this group, I can get adaptations in any group.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was really important to me. And then mm-hmm. I just started going, I'm going to push them. I'm going to watch them. I'm going to take care of them. I'm not going to do anything mm-hmm. crazy here. This isn't far left side of ideas. It's training individuals, watching them and monitoring them closely. Yeah. And, that's how it sort of launched my career in this and started writing programming for this particular group.
Thanks. Now, we're going to switch gears and we're going into one of our favorite sections of our podcast called Rapid Fire Questions.
Oh, man. I can't elaborate. I just have to do the yes, no, or something?
No. We always say try to give like a one sentence answer, but Terry always makes it longer.
I'm an old professor. I'm an old professor. I talk forever. I lecture on this stuff all the time.
Well, we're going to throw them at you pretty fast and furious. So here, okay. if you're ready, Riggs, we got it. You ready?
Okay.
All right, here we go. Question number one. You lived and spent a lot of time in Aspen, obviously Aspen, Colorado. And as a ski instructor, what is one of your fondest memories?
Fondest memories? I have a lot. But you know what? Jimmy Buffett just died, and I got to ski with Jimmy a couple times, long time ago in the back day. He was cool. He was a cool guy. He had a house up here. He has some really good stories. And during COVID, he actually filmed from Florida down in Key West for the graduating class of Aspen High School. He filmed a song and he sent it to him online. And so, you get to meet some pretty cool people up here.
That's cool.
That's just one. So there's a lot of those.
That was good. All right. So far, so good. Here's question number two. You've obviously met some amazing people, gifted athletes and people. What is your one person that stands out and why?
I've never met this one, but Alex Honnold, and actually watching Solo at least 4 or 5 times, the climber who soloed El Capitan on unaided, right? I've always been enamored with world-class athletes, and I know a lot of them. I've never seen somebody so mentally strong in my entire life to do an event like that. I think it took him under 4 hours to climb up that thing without rope, 3,000 straight up. I bend El Cap and I put my hand on the wall. I didn't even know how you actually step onto the wall. So how he does that. But I think the mental fortitude of some of the athletes is fascinating to me, and how you can control your emotions and your fears to be able to do an athletic event that strenuous is really cool.
I agree.
I was out there not to climb, but from several miles away. And the tour guy was telling us how 20 people die a year, and that's why they have a helicopter right there. It's like, oh my God. So to hear that, that's pretty fascinating. Question number three. What is your go-to activity to open up your brain when you are trying to figure something out?
I'm an old swimmer. I still love to swim.
Hmm. Very good.
But I remember after I finished my college career, I was like, I want to go see something also. So I ride my bike quite a bit. So I can get out. We live in the mountains. And so, yes, I love to road ride and do all the things. I was living in Southern California. I did a lot of road riding. But, man, you could also just disappear up into the mountains on a mountain bike. And, if you had a little stressor during the morning, that might take care of it a little bit for the afternoon. Always makes me a little bit happier in the afternoon. So maybe tired, but happy. Yeah. So that's it.
Great. All right. Now I love this, this one. You're the biggest public myth, when it comes to cancer prevention.
Myth in prevention.
Myth or misconception, something that people think is, I mean, we've actually touched off on a couple of things.
That it's all genetics. I'm just going to get it. There's nothing I can do to control that. But we look at the genetic environmental interaction.
Yeah.
Meaning, okay, maybe, you know, Spencer, maybe you're at high risk for developing lung cancer, but you don't smoke. So you're not going to get, right? You're not most likely not going to get lung cancer. So what you do has a tremendous effect on the amount of cancer that we're seeing, right? And so that environmental pollutants, exposures, UV radiation, whatever it might be, those have a tremendous effect on the expression of that cancer. Poor nutrition has an expression, right? So it isn't, these aren't just my cards and I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
I can do a lot to prevent it.
I'm so glad you said that, because some people feel like it's their death sentence when they find out, you know, they get the genetic testing or, you know, any kind of, you know, or their parents.
How about the exposure to that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
And I think, Spencer, you know, and you guys could go down this and probably have. I haven't seen all the podcasts. I've seen a few of them. But, you know, like what we put into our mouths have got to be some of the biggest problems in the United States.
Yeah.
Not just the amount, but also the quality of it. So, you know, are those causing insults that are causing the mutations that are causing the cancers?
Yeah.
My thought? Yeah, probably.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks. Good answer. Last and final question. What is your favorite place to go to for an adventure?
Oh, gosh. I've traveled all over the world. I don't know. That's a... my next on my trip list is Mallorca, Spain. I want to go ride around in those mountains. I can tell you that. That's high on my list. I've been to Everest Base Camp. I don't climb. I'm not a climber, but I've been to Everest Base Camp. I'd like to take my son back there. That's on my list of thinking of things to do. Adventures. Oh, gosh. But that's the coolest thing. Man, I used to, as a professor, you get to stand up occasionally and say, I used to tell the kids, I said, go travel and go see that world out there. Go to all those places because it's so cool and you'll have such a great appreciation. So where am I going next for an adventure? I don't know, but I always have an idea about somewhere where I want to go see. So that's my best answer there.
That's great. That's great. So we'll have to talk off air of where we can go ski together, and hey, we'll pick a place that we haven't gone before, and we'll go have some fun. All right. So you did a recent publication in 2023 exploring the motivational sources in the NCAA Division II student athletes during the COVID pandemic. Can you discuss the implications of this study and how it might shape future understandings of the psychological effects and athletic performance?
That's a good question. We were trying to see what's going on. You know, we obviously have a student, everybody went through it, right? So all student athletes had to go in quarantine as well. And they were trying to do independent work at home or training. And we were interested in like, what was that going to be on the psyche of that particular group compared to the general population of the school at that point? You know, I was at a school moderate size, about 5,500 students. So we could kind of get a large group to answer those questions. And it was, you know, we had two ideas. Are the athletes more resilient and can handle it better or than the general population or not? That was one. Or were they just going to fall apart? And I think, unfortunately, what we found out of there is sort of a mixed bag, if you will, Terry. Like, they're motivated, but it was so difficult to transition to, like, let's say you're on a soccer team, for instance, American, you know, traditional football club. You don't have a team to work out with. That really sends that particular group into depression, anxiety. You know, this is my one shot to perform at the highest level that I'm ever going to make it in life. And so they lost those opportunities. So that research was a little bit sort of mixed. We saw some resiliency, but we also saw the loss of especially team sports with regards to, you know, they wanted their camaraderie. They wanted a team. They wanted to have that experience. You know, some individual sports may be a little bit different. If you're on the cross country team, yeah, you have a team, but it's an individual sport, if that makes any sense. So that was the big difference that we just saw in that particular group.
Riggs, we're going to wrap it up, but I got one more thoughtful question for you about where do you see your future with exercise and cancer treatments, and how do you feel other healthcare professionals should prepare for this shift in consciousness?
That is really, you know, to forecast is going to be difficult. I think, Spencer, where I'm at, I can only see a certain amount of time right now, but I see that could exercise be very beneficial during the treatment phase. And I'm talking about a cancer patient that has to sit in a chair for 6 hours and to go through chemotherapy. That's a lot of time to sit to start with. And there's some complications during chemo and infusion therapy. Would it be beneficial for them to actually be moving while it's happening?
Oh, yeah. You know,
that's a thought, you know? And so our good friend Terry's and I, we had him doing some light exercise during infusion therapy. Now, I'm sure there's a few nurses in that room that weren't happy about that. but if you think about, you want a drug to come and do its job in your body, but then you want it to get out of your body. Mm-hmm. Well, sitting isn't going to help that. And, you know, blood flow is going to help that. So would that be something that we should be doing regularly? I don't think we know the answer to that. So I'm going to keep that really narrow, like in the future. Like, that's something that we're experimenting with right now. And there's some really, Chris McCampbell up in Canada is doing some work on that, and some really good people doing that too. I think I would just hope, you know, they're going to try to be a little open to some of our modalities here. That's all. You know, there's always that group that just, it's new, it's novel, we're not doing it. But there's this, right. And so I think that it goes across the medical profession. And we just want to do it safely too as well. So that's where I'm at.
Love it. Great stuff.
Perfect. Thanks, Doc. We really appreciate your time, man. And it's always good to see you. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Yeah, I love talking about this stuff. I obviously can talk about it forever, so it's all fun. Thanks, Terry. It's great to see you. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Great to meet you.
You too.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Crackin' Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Crackin' Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.